Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, where we cover trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world, our communities, and bring them a mental health perspective. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I am joined by Allison Franklin. Allison is a nationally recognized survivor, leader, and subject matter expert on sex trafficking, sexual exploitation, drug abuse, mental health, and the intersection of these within the criminal justice system. She has extensive experience advocating for survivors, working at national, state, and local levels with numerous stakeholders to find innovative solutions to fight human trafficking. She provides technical assistance and trains law enforcement, those within the court systems, and health professionals across the United States. She is currently the director of the CARES program at Safe Alliance, providing comprehensive services for trafficked youth ages 12 to 24. Allison, welcome to our show. It's so nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I am as well. You know, in my introduction today, you allowed me to share that you are a survivor of trafficking and exploitation. Before we get into your work endeavors and all that you're doing, may I ask that as we start the show today, that you share with us your personal story?
Yes, I sure will. A very brief version of it, but really my story starts before trafficking. It really begins with childhood sexual abuse. That's unfortunately a common tragic thread with a large portion of the survivors that we work with. Severe childhood sexual abuse from 3 to probably 10 just launched me on a journey of self-destruction that probably spanned over 34 years. I had complex trauma as a very young kid. Mm-hmm. So I had developmental trauma, which goes with behavioral health issues, mental health issues, substance abuse issues, and all those things that are entailed in that. With that created increased vulnerabilities. I started running away, exhibiting risky behaviors, and found myself homeless in the streets of Houston with no clothes, no food, no place to sleep. Started engaging in commercial sex work or survival sex just to get my most basic needs met. I was targeted within the first hour, I think, by my first predator. Mm. Not trafficker, but sexual predator that convinced me that he loved me and cared about me for the sole purpose of sexually exploiting me for his own purposes. Mm. He did become abusive physically, so I ran from him back to the streets and found myself introduced to gangs. Mm. So they are the ones that actually introduced me to drugs, and they offered the same thing to protect me, mm-hmm. care about me, provide me a sense of family and connection. We're all wired for human connection.
Yeah, we are.
And they actually share that I could make more money and engage in less commercial sex work if I went back home and started selling drugs in middle school. Mm. So I went back home over a period of time. I actually graduated high school because that's where my best customers were. I did run frequently as a frequent runaway. And my mom actually put me in my first mental institution at age 14. Mm-hmm. So with that, increased vulnerabilities, now I'm involved in gangs and drugs at a level outside of just commercial sex work, right? And I tried to relocate. So I tried to move away and get away, you know, from that area and that location. But the interesting thing about that is wherever you go, there you are. So right. All that ugly trauma, right, reared its ugly head, right. And I started to engage in risky behaviors again. Eventually, I came back to Texas, and I started cooking and selling methamphetamines, mm-hmm. and then my boyfriend got me involved in heroin. My substance use and abuse turned into addiction, and that just spiraled out of control. Yeah. So I started to engage in commercial sex work again, and eventually that led to human trafficking. Okay. So I was already active in the life, active in my addiction, already heavily seated with the gangs. And the area that I worked in, still selling drugs, was heavily controlled by gangs, the Crips. Mm-hmm. They saw how much money I was making and didn't want some of it. They wanted all of it. Mm. So members would be ordered to kidnap me, force me to prostitute, beat me, rape me. I would run. I don't know why, but I always went back to the same area. Big surprise, they would find me again. But my real trafficker actually pretended to rescue me from them. So I can remember that day perfectly. I was running down the service road, and a person that had already targeted me was shooting at me, and I had so little self-worth that I was more concerned about the $1,000 in my pocket than I was him hurting me. So I ran and I hid my money that I worked so hard for. Obviously, he's in a vehicle, so he was able to catch up to me. And he got out and started to, we call it pistol whooping, but hit me over the head with the butt of his gun. And my trafficker walked up and told him to leave me alone. So I sat on the curb while they spoke. You know, I'm nursing my wounded head. And same thing that the sexual predator shared, same thing that the gangs shared. Oh, you're so pretty. You shouldn't be out here. I can help you. I can protect right. you, provide you all those, you know, those unmet needs that you have and vulnerabilities. Sounded pretty good, right? As I'm bleeding out of my head. So I actually left with him. What I didn't realize, though, is that the grooming process had already begun. And what I didn't know is they actually worked together as an organized crime unit or gang to essentially recruit and traffic women, amongst other, you know, organized gang activity. So over time, I not only was his property and prostitute, but I was groomed to recruit other women, men, also purchase all his drugs, sell all his drugs, take the penitentiary risk for his drugs, move guns, money, anything that you could think of, you name it, we did it. Completely insulating him from any type of criminal justice involvement. It's not unusual. Over 90% of trafficking victims have a history of, you know, being arrested, and probably half of those more than nine times. It's called victim-offender overlap. So that is definitely the story on that end. I was not rescued or identified. I was misidentified or labeled. Instead, I cycled in and out of our prison system. And instead of getting meaningful services, I would just cycle in and out of, you know, services provided in a punitive way, only to have my trafficker pick me back up, right, once I got out of jail. For nearly a decade, I went to two mental institutions after that. I spent over 10 years collectively behind bars and five trips to prison. So it wasn't until my ninth felony that I actually got access to meaningful services. And that's where I was able to, you know, start to break that cycle.
You mentioned meaningful. Something shifted and something changed at that point.
Yeah, meaningful services as far as trauma-informed approach. They were knowledgeable about the effects of trauma, and they were gender-specific. They were not mandatory. They were choice-based, right, voluntary. And I think even at that point, I didn't self-identify. Right. As a trafficking victim, right. That wasn't my pimp. That was my husband. He loved me. Right. So it actually took the foresight of someone else identifying me that was able to make that connection for me.
That's really an interesting point around maybe not knowing what you're in and being able to define it really for what it is. Right. And part of the meaningful services you're saying is someone coming in and letting you know, educating very specifically, helping you name and know really what's going on. It's probably multidimensionally, because when we're in it, sometimes we don't know it and we don't know how to recognize what it is we're in. And part of the meaningfulness of that sounds like it was someone really helping you understand really what you're in and what you're caught up in. I also really liked your point that there's different kinds of traumas, but you're talking about a complex trauma, and complex traumas really lead to subsequent vulnerability. So the vulnerability makes one apt to get caught up in something more and then something more and then something more, really a slippery slope. And that vulnerability is really driven by just what you said also, there's that human need for protection, for family, for that kind of sense of self in relationship with other people, and how that is such an important thing that always drives us, always brings us back, and unchecked and with the wrong people can really make us vulnerable, can it?
Right. And that's what makes us human, right? And it's basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Yeah. You need to feel safe. You need to have your most basic needs met. You need to feel loved. And you can't thrive without that. And that's exactly right. What traffickers target.
Yeah, I want to back out just a wee bit and pick up on what you just said right there. I want to understand who is most at risk. If you could paint a picture for me, you shared yours, which I appreciate your transparency and vulnerability around in doing so, but paint a picture for me of the child or young adult, male or female, because this is not just females, males as well, that is most vulnerable. Typically their home situation, maybe their sense of self, their attachments with adults in their life, socially what's going on with their peers. Give me a sense of who's most at risk.
Yeah, I mean, this can happen to anyone. It absolutely can. And trafficking victims can be any age, race, gender, nationality, men, women, young, old. I've even mentored people that were trafficked at 60, right?
Wow.
And so the unfortunate underlying threads here and tragic narratives that nearly every single survivor or victim carries is childhood sexual abuse, number one. Absolutely number one.
Okay.
I would say 95% of the persons that we work with and research supports this has a history of childhood sexual abuse.
Okay.
We also know that with childhood sexual abuse, it's generally someone close in their proximity, right? A family member, a caretaker, which totally disrupts their attachment styles.
Absolutely.
So then individuals have completely limited their nurturing cues, right? So they are actually unable to attract to healthy people, right? So they actually are targeted for those very reasons. Huge intersections with race and poverty. Also age. Age is a huge vulnerability. Runaways, throwaways. There's a huge connection with our child welfare system, our juvenile justice system. As well, limited education, family support, right? Just those broken homes. And oftentimes, sometimes family members are traffickers, right?
Yeah.
So there's that aspect as well. But those mental health issues, substance abuse issues, and all of those most often stem from trauma.
Got
right?
it.
Childhood trauma.
Yeah. So we've got the child, young adult, really, as you're saying, any age that can be vulnerable. The predator, how are they luring and grooming their victims? In other words, how are they able to spot vulnerable people to bring into this life?
Yeah, I do support groups in a lot of different locations, but one is a state juvenile correctional facility. So it's actually a prison for youth with really high charges, like a capital murder, attempted murder. I can remember one of the girls sharing with me, she's like, I feel like I have just abuse me and use me tattooed on my forehead, right? I mean, these predators have adept instincts at picking up on those stuff. So, I mean, it's body language. It's what you share. They can see those vulnerabilities and just completely pick up on them. So you're targeted, right? That's the first part. And then you're lured. And it could look a number of ways. But generally, for the most part, it's that human connection, right?
Got it. Yeah.
That love, that attention, you know, a feeling of worth, right? And that's generally what we see with those that we work with.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because the thing we need most is used as the bait to lure us in.
Right. Yeah. And that's those nurturing cues, right? That
that's
are
right.
just totally wiped out with that trauma.
Allison, with the person going through this, I'm curious what their self-narrative is. What is the person saying to themselves about themselves as they're in it and trapped in this world of trafficking and exploitation?
A great, great quote. And I think it's from Andrea, I don't want to slaughter her last name, Borkin, but incest is boot camp for prostitution, right? So that's a training ground. 80% of prostitutes actually have reported childhood sexual abuse.
Yes.
70% report incest. So that creates a huge scarcity of hope, right? It defines your sexuality and your relationship to the world even before trafficking. So oftentimes that lack of self-worth and self-esteem, that's also a vulnerability, right, that traffickers target.
Yeah.
And what they do is they meet the need, right? That's what we do
that's
in
right.
our work. We
right.
we spot the need, we target it, and we meet it, but in a healthy way. That's exactly
that's
what
right.
traffickers do. While you're in it, I mean, it depends on what stage you're in, right? So if you're in the grooming stage, right, or the honeymoon stage, that's your boyfriend. He loves you. I mean, it depends on what type of trafficking is going on because there's different types of, you know, typologies of traffickers. But in that instance, that Romeo boyfriend pimp, which is more common than the other type of pimps. Then when you're in it and that trauma bonding is set in, for me, I think in most of the clients that I work with, and we can talk about trauma bonding later, it's just holding on to this small, small acts of kindness, which is part of, you know, the, you can look at Birdman's chart of coercion, that little small act of kindness, right? Or Stockholm syndrome is what you hang on to, right? To make the moment livable.
You're just so holding on to and trying to create that small little act of kindness.
That reality, right? That false reality.
I guess that's one of the things I was going to ask next too, is psychologically, you know, what is one trapped in this doing to cope and emotionally survive their experience? I think you just answered it right there. They're really working hard in their narrative about who this person is, what their relationship really is, trying to get that connection, trying to sustain that as long as possible, really working hard, aren't they?
They really, really are. And this is when we get into the conversations, because I work a lot on victim-offender overlap or bottom bitches. And those are the ones that run the entire enterprise. And they're usually the ones that get the criminal charge. But we don't take in consideration their victimization when assessing their culpability. And these are the most broken and the most victimized. So me taking on that role or that narrative, that false narrative to make that moment livable, that's a sign of my surrender. Like, I have completely surrendered and I am completely under your control now and I will do whatever you say.
What makes seeking help so difficult? But when you're talking about the truly deepest unmet need for protection, family, connection, and this seems to be the only place where they're getting some form of that, I would imagine seeking help can be so difficult just to reach out. And also what you said earlier seemed like it might fit as well of sometimes we don't even know what we don't know about what we're in. So in terms of seeking help, what does make that so difficult?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why. Part of trafficking is you're completely isolated from any of your old friends and family. So you have completely removed yourself from your support systems. Yeah. And to reach out even on that level is so shameful and embarrassing because of the sex work, obviously, you're with a monster, right? And then generally, for the most part, you're probably using substances as well, if you weren't already. So terribly, terribly shameful. Or you have put them into survival mode and they've completely cut you off, right? They don't want nothing to do with you. Right. And they've lost hope in you. Also, that narrative, I'm not going to turn my husband in. I love him. Like, my trafficker stabbed me in my chest and I told him to run with my own knife so that law enforcement didn't catch him in case I died. That is crazy, right? That's trauma bonding though. Very, very serious. Plus, I mean, for me, I was re-victimized by the very systems that were supposed to help and protect me.
Right.
Law enforcement's taking me to jail, right? Yeah. Even though all the signs are there, why would I go to them, right? Yeah. So that climate of fear, as well as fear of my trafficker. I mean, he had already, you know, beat me beyond recognition nearly a decade, tons of times. He had chained me to a stove, hit me with a moving truck, you know, a whole lot of different things. Like, yeah, I'm definitely afraid to leave. Every time I did leave or, you know, tried to leave, it didn't turn out well for me. Threats to your family, right? Yeah. Your friends, those are all very real. Huge, huge concerns. The other part of that too, I think, I mean, it depends on the length of time there, but, you know, those barriers can be that criminal record, right? You can't get a job nowhere. You haven't worked in so many years.
You have
gaps in your employment.
Yeah. As you're sharing those things, you're talking about with any trauma, there's always warning signs, and behaviors and emotional patterns that get displayed in those that are being exploited or harmed somehow. But we don't often know, let's just say those on the outside, what we're looking at that is actually telling us that they are in trouble and in need of help. For those that might have somebody engaged in this life that are around them, how could they best detect or identify some of the early warning signs, maybe even subtle ones, of a child or a young person caught up in their life? You've been very clear about some so far, but go back over some of those things that we could use, signs and symptoms, if you will, for early detection.
Yeah, especially in maybe youth, young adults, it can look a lot differently because you have different push and pull factors, right? But for youth, change in friends, like all their old friends and activities that they used to do, going to the mall or, you know, certain friends that they used to hang out with, they start to just taper off. Mm-hmm. Their grades might go down. Sudden changes in behavior or mood swings, change in language, clothing, right? There's a certain type of subculture and language that goes with what we call the life in the game. And so they can be picking up on those terms. Two phones, an older boyfriend, sneaking out at night. You can look at their online social profiles, pretty much pick up on what's going on there as well. Coming home with expensive items, you know, they can't afford, like that Gucci purse, or maybe their nails are done.
Yeah.
You know, inconsistencies in their stories. There's a lot of signs on that.
Yeah, I appreciate those. Those are, if we can see these things, begin to kind of add them together and begin to at least raise some questions. Mm-hmm. The challenge here is if we see it, great, that's part of it. How are we going to be able to talk about it? As you're talking about these early warning signs and the behaviors, the emotional patterns that we can see, what are some of the misconceptions that you'd like to clear up for us as we talk about this world and this life?
Yeah, I think for me, the misconception of choice, that people are choosing to be out there. I mean, not only do I hear that about adults and youth, but that's a really harmful narrative, right? Like, they enjoy this life. They make a lot of money. They have autonomy in this. It's agency. Right. And that is whether you have a trafficker or not. And I know this is probably a hot topic here, and it's definitely a divided area. And not to say that people shouldn't have an avenue to get their needs met, even if it is sex work, but sex work is not safe. And when we sell that narrative, we're actually packaging oppression as empowerment. The other one is oftentimes the kids that are lured into this already have issues, criminal justice issues, behavior issues, mental health issues. You know, all those labels are harmful, right? Because they're bad kids.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
They're doing this to be defiant. They're acting out. They're rebellious. And that's harmful as well. Also, that it's just, you know, international or undocumented, but it's happening to kids from here, right? They're trafficked here. They don't even leave their hometown, right? It's happening in your own backyard.
That's right.
And that, you know, it's just girls and women. There's boys, there's trans that also are affected by this, or that maybe if they could leave, they would.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think what you're saying there too, that I appreciate you said at the beginning of talking about the misconceptions, if we have that narrative, it makes someone further trapped and we don't get to further appreciate really what it is that they're in, nor help them develop another narrative as to what they're in order to find a way out. So,
yeah.
Hey, I would love to hear about the SAFE program that you're doing and the differences that you're seeing in the lives of the survivors that come through your program and how it's making a difference.
Yeah, sure. So we actually have a very, very comprehensive program. We're in Austin, Texas, but we generally have a culture of diversity and inclusion. We provide targeted interventions, especially focusing on those vulnerability factors that we were just going over on the life course dynamics, right? Commonly experienced. So CARES actually purposely addresses economic and social costs of trafficking with a survivor focus prevention. So what that looks like actually is meeting those complex needs, right? And creating that felt safety and real safety. I have found that most of the survivors that we work with, their trauma, not just trafficking trauma, is relationship-based.
Yes.
So the way that we turn that trauma around is with relationships as well.
That's right.
We do provide 24/7 crisis response in our community. We run off two hotlines for law enforcement, healthcare professionals, or hospitals. but just making that first connection, right, with those clients while they're experiencing that crisis and connecting the services. And then we also, with that, we can engage them past that crisis, right, and create that ongoing relationship and support. We have extensive case management. We offer choice-based services. So we do have support groups. We have psychosexual education. All of our programming is ran through our drop-in center, which is accessible to clients. Just walk in. You can come in right off the street, right? A lot of our clients are homeless, so that's obviously a huge intersection, right? And they can come in and get a shower, get a meal, get some case management, therapy, wash their clothes, all those types of things. Yeah, it's an amazing program. We just try to build resiliency and foster personal growth and development and stability, tools for self-care and self-celebration.
What I love about that is that it is rooted in the very thing that they got exploited for in terms of having a need from the very beginning, that of that core need of connection and protection and family and connectedness. And what you folks are doing, it sounds in such beautiful ways, is providing corrective emotional experiences with those that really can love them selflessly and benevolently, and giving them a relationship that helps them back out of a world that brought them in for that need being exploited in the very worst possible way. The greatest betrayal is taking someone's core need like that,
right,
and using it against them for selfish endeavors. And how wonderful that must be for these young ladies and these men, let's just say of any age, that get to have, maybe for the very first time, someone that loves them just for them without any cost to them.
Yeah, we work really hard on meeting our clients right where they're at.
I'll bet you do. It sounds like it. Hey, we're going to wind down here just a second, but I'd like to know if you want to share with us, and it'd be nice to hear of some resources that you might, in addition to your program, some resources, ways to reach out, someone on the street, or maybe a therapist working with somebody here. What are some resources that you'd like us to have?
Yeah, and I mean, I think obviously it depends on your community. Different communities have different resources. And so that looks a lot different in rural and urban areas. So I encourage anyone to invest in being knowledgeable about the resources in your own community. But we generally refer to the Human Trafficking Hotline, and that is 1-888-373-7888. You can also text HELP, and that is to 233-733-BE-FREE. You can also, I encourage you to look at Polaris. They have an amazing setup of information and resources. They actually are the host of the Human Trafficking Hotline, for the National Human Trafficking Hotline. Shared Hope is great as well for therapy. Obviously, we have our own therapy, and it can depend a lot on what your insurance looks like. Huge barrier as well. So that's the unfortunate part about that.
Okay. Well, as we kind of wind down today, you know, the sexual exploitation and trafficking are real, and they are so embedded, as you're helping us appreciate even more today, in our society, in our backyard, as you're saying, sadly. And it's something that is easy to become outraged about or have misconceptions about, but it's often really hard to actually look at it and lean into it to bring about change. And I really appreciate, Allison, you know, your transparency and being open with us today about your history and the context you're kind of giving us to give us such an understanding of how you have come in to be so helpful, and not only just as a survivor, but also someone who is really thriving themselves and really stewarding your life efforts to help other survivors reclaim their lives that they were intended to have and to help them live to their truest potential. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been great to have you. And to those listening in, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to having you with us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.